From 90.5 WESA, this is The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. In 2016, Pennsylvania joined 29 other states in putting Donald Trump in the White House.
I pledge to every citizen of our land that I will be president for all Americans.
But what about his relationship with the Pittsburgh area that voted heavily in favor of Hillary Clinton? Pittsburgh loses the police chief.
Please understand, improvements only come about with change.
But gets a new superintendent for its city schools after controversy over his resume and allegations of plagiarism. A burning bridge forces tens of thousands of motorists to find alternate routes, and along the way, they spotted self-driving cars on the city streets. A panel of six journalists will discuss this year's top stories and how they impacted our region. It's our Year in Review show on The Confluence, where the news comes together. But first, this news update. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. From presidential politics to police in politics, from a burning bridge to a newspaper shutting down, from Pittsburgh public schools getting a new leader to self-driving cars on Pittsburgh streets. It's been a year of news that has greatly impacted our region. To discuss the top stories and how they affected us, we've invited a panel of Pittsburgh journalists. Jeremy Bourne is digital managing editor for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Welcome back to the show, Jeremy.
Thanks, Kevin.
Chris Potter is reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Good to have you here, Chris.
Always good to be here.
Kim Lyons is a freelance reporter and writer. Kim.
Thanks so much for having me.
Rebecca Addison is the news editor for Pittsburgh City Paper. Welcome,
thanks,
Rebecca.
Thanks for having me.
And Mark Newtbar, senior reporter for WESA. Mark, good to have you.
Thank you for having us.
Okay, top news story, obviously here across the country, the presidential election. We're 3 weeks away from the inauguration of President-elect Trump, and we're more than 7 weeks removed from the election. So we've had some time to reflect, to report on how this campaign, how the election played out in here in southwestern Pennsylvania in particular. So what are those reflections? Let's start with Jeremy.
Well, that it almost in a way hasn't ended since, the president-elect has gone on this tour of similar events that he had during the campaign. It's kind of like it's still going on in my mind. And it seems almost as though the president-elect is continuing in this campaign mode and, you know, tweeting in that way and also having the rallies. You know, I think there was one pretty recently in Hershey, you know. It's kind of like it's difficult, I think, to sort of adjust to the thought of having a new president, since it just strikes me that the campaign's still underway in many ways.
So the tone hasn't really seemed to change.
It doesn't
much.
Seem like it's changed yet. You know, I'm kind of waiting for it to shift into that, you know, other gear that we're accustomed to when there's a change in administrations. Maybe that'll happen next month when
Chris
the inauguration
Potter.
Happens.
Oh, I'm sorry, Jeremy. Chris Potter.
Yeah, I mean, the other part of that dynamic, too, is it's really hard, even as somebody who pretty much went to every Donald Trump rally and read his position papers, such as they were, to even really know what's coming exactly. What is he going to do exactly to benefit coal miners, who are sort of a key constituency for him in western Pennsylvania and elsewhere? What does it mean to drain the swamp when several of your top cabinet picks are former employees, former executives of Goldman Sachs? And you ran sort of against Goldman Sachs in particular and Wall Street in general. So much is up in the air, in part because this is a fledgling administration, in part because Mr. Trump, and it obviously worked for him, was able to sort of campaign, I want to say without promising much, but in a way he promised everything at the same time. And it made it difficult for me, and I think for probably a lot of other people, to kind of know what we're getting here. I think what we saw here in western Pennsylvania was a microcosm of this campaign. You had Hillary Clinton coming in. Pretty much every time she visited western Pennsylvania, she came to Pittsburgh, the city itself, very often to the East End, downtown. Mr. Trump, after a single visit during the primary to downtown Pittsburgh, we talked about bringing steel back, and everyone in Pittsburgh was why would you want to do that? We just spent 30 years trying to put steel in a rearview mirror. Spent the rest of the campaign out in places like Johnstown and Ambridge and Manassas and places like that where the renaissance, the resurgence of Pittsburgh didn't really catch up with those places. And he obviously connected with those areas in a way that pretty much, it certainly surprised the Hillary campaign. It surprised a lot of people in the press and pollsters as well. And I think that's what defined that race, along with some some other interventions by the FBI and perhaps by the Russians as well. So we kind of know what happened with that race, but I don't think anybody has a good sense of where it's headed.
So his message didn't necessarily change. He just moved where he was delivering the message?
Yeah, I mean, I think a few things went on. I think he absolutely found his audience, and that was to the credit of himself and his team. They were very shrewd about that. And I think he sort of promised a populist sort of mode of governance that was not going to be particularly bound by, you know, typical Republican ideology, which tends to be very much in favor of free trade as a general rule. He went against that. That was the linchpin of his campaign, is being against kind of these free trade deals. So he went against all of that stuff. The question now is, as we see him build this cabinet, and we wait to kind of see what sort of policies he's going to adopt, what does Obamacare repeal really mean? What are we replacing it with? I think that's he just never got pinned down on that, and so consequently, I think we really don't know to a very large extent what we're going to be getting in January.
Okay, Kim Lyons.
Yeah, I was just going to say it's also kind of shown how rudderless the Democratic Party is on a national level, and you know, not so much on a local level, but what's it going to mean on the local level for the very blue Allegheny County and now very red Pennsylvania? What is it going to mean to have a President Trump in the White House for Bill Peduto, who was a very staunch supporter of Hillary Clinton every time she came to town? I think a lot of people too have been frustrated by, you know, the Obamas, President Obama and Michelle Obama, you know, taking that when they go low, we go high, and staying high and pledging to do whatever they can to help the Trump transition team. But at the same time, many Democrats feeling very, very frustrated that, well, what's happening here? Why is no one taking the opposition? We are, you know, we may have lost, but we still need to have our voices heard and our seat at the table. And I think it's really exposed a very, you know, thin bench going forward. Who's our logical next steps here for the party?
Rebecca?
So pretty quickly after the election, City Paper actually did a story where, you know, we talked about how Pittsburgh has not gotten a lot of support from the state, but where we have gotten a lot of support is from, you know, Obama's administration and the federal government. And, you know, sort of, you know, what does that look like now that those kinds of grants that we competed for are going to be drying up, and where, you know, liberal, progressive cities like Pittsburgh probably won't be as supported.
Mark Newbar.
Yeah, and kind of taking some of the other points that have been made, this is moving forward. And from a non-political standpoint, everybody is still talking about this. I cannot go to any type of an event, to any type of an interview, where somewhere along the line it doesn't come up, well, we don't know what next year holds, or somebody is just frustrated as we go through, you know, a lot of people are going through mourning, it seems, and they just want to talk to you as a reporter about, well, what do you see? What do you think? What happened? And it just continues to play out. And I don't know, maybe all the way up through the inauguration, we're just going to have that confusion.
Over the past 2 weeks, I've spoken with both Mayor Peduto and County Exec Fitzgerald, and they're still trying to figure out what the heck this means, a Trump administration means for the city, for Allegheny County, for this region. Have we figured out anything about the relationship between Washington and Pittsburgh, Allegheny County, with the Trump administration? Yeah, Jeremy.
I don't think we have, but to Kim and Rebecca's point, I mean, I agree that those fears are definitely there for Allegheny County and the city of Pittsburgh. But the irony is that, I mean, isn't that what drain the swamp means, is that there wouldn't be this political machine that would punish you for voting a different way, that you wouldn't have that sort of machine politics working against you just because you're on the other side of the aisle? I know it sounds idealistic, but isn't that sort of the whole theme or ethos of that? You know, popular sentiment is that the federal government wouldn't bring down the hammer just because you want another way.
Chris Potter?
Yeah, and I think the other thing going forward in 2017 is going to be very important to watch is the behavior of Senator Pat Toomey, who was obviously reelected himself in a fairly tight race. Mr. Toomey, a very ideological Republican, very conservative, very kind of free trade Republican, a guy who believes in laissez-faire government. So here's a guy who's talked about being against picking the winners and the losers in the economy, and he now has a president who just sort of picked a winner in Carrier, the furnace and air conditioning maker out in Indiana, by giving them a lot of tax incentives. It's going to be very interesting to see how and to what extent, if at all, Senator Toomey starts to push back on this administration. Part of what he campaigned on is, I, unlike my opponent, will be a check on the White House no matter who happens to be in it. And he is going. It's going to be very interesting to see how he responds now and whether he actually lives up to that promise.
Kim?
Would behoove Mayor Peduto and other local Democratic officials to look to the example of Massachusetts, maybe. I believe it was Governor of Massachusetts, or maybe it was the mayor of Boston, who recently said, you know, we're going to keep going business as usual. This is, you know, we're this obviously a traditionally very blue state. It went blue again. And they expect to keep doing business as usual because they can't plan for any other eventuality. But I do think, to Jeremy's point, that, you know, the idealistic drain the swamp would suggest that, yes, of course, the Washington would never retaliate. But when you have the president-elect, you know, tweeting his disapproval of a restaurant review, it's a little bit difficult to envision him not being angry at political foes or political opponents in a similar way.
And how sweet does the carrot from Washington have to be for a Bill Peduto to sidle up alongside a Trump idea and a Trump plan?
You could ask Mitt Romney, I guess.
Yep, perhaps.
Chris Potter, since you brought up Donald Trump and also Pat Toomey, I do want to mention Donald Trump won Pennsylvania by, I believe it was about 44,000 votes or so. Pat Toomey won re-election by just around 100,000. So here's my question to you all. Did Trump help Toomey? Did Toomey help Trump? Or were they just completely unrelated? Rebecca, thoughts?
So this is kind of against the topic, but another question that we've been struggling with is, why did the Democratic candidate for Attorney General win?
And I want to get to that. Why did why was it a sweep for the Dems in the row offices? But anything in particular on Toomey and Trump? Was there just a disconnect there?
No, I think Toomey's unwillingness to say he was either for or against Trump really did help him. And I think that obviously resonated with a lot of voters who were obviously unsure of Trump himself and ended up not voting for him.
Kim, you're shaking your head.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I think also that, you know, Toomey, much like Trump, had an opponent who maybe didn't define herself as well as Trump's voters or Toomey's voters would have liked. I think Katie McGinty was a candidate that could have defined herself better than just being not Pat Toomey. I think maybe she didn't do that strongly enough or well enough, and the result was that Pat Toomey won.
The other issue that she had and shared with Hillary Clinton, of course, is that they both had long histories in government, Katie McGinty, both in state and White House politics, and that history got used against her to no small extent and to no small effect. So that was going for the Toomey campaign. I actually think he and Trump ran sort of parallel campaigns, and so they didn't intersect very much. In fact, you can look at, I grew up, for example, in Upper St. Clair. If you look at the results in Upper St. Clair, Hillary, there are actually precincts in Upper St. Clair that Hillary Clinton won. And it's because support for Donald Trump was driven very much by education, level of education, and the vast majority of people in Upper St. Clair are college educated, and a lot of them, I think, were just put off by that. But those same folks came back and were very comfortable voting for a Pat Toomey because he is sort of in the mainline expectation of what a Republican is going to be. So they appeal to, there's obviously a lot of overlap there, but I think in the key area, you know, in the margins where elections are really won, that's where they parted company.
Let me turn your question on its head, Kevin. I think Hillary Clinton is what helped Pat Toomey. The fact that people were not ready to vote, perhaps, as readily able to vote for Trump, but they still wanted to make sure there was some sort of a check against Hillary Clinton. Let's make sure that the Senate doesn't go her way. So I think maybe a few people did that and said, you know what, I'm going to go ahead and vote for this conservative that maybe I don't like as much, but I want to make sure that there is a check and a balance still in Washington. And then we wound up with something completely different.
Let's get to a point that Rebecca raised a couple minutes ago, and that has to do with the Democrats sweeping the state row offices, Auditor General, Attorney General, and Treasurer. So did the Republican victories for president and U.S. Senate not help there, or did they help but not enough? Because they were fairly close races. The biggest margin was 5 percentage points, and that was with the incumbent Auditor General DePasquale. The other two races for treasurer and attorney general were only 2 percentage points differences. Rebecca, let's start with you on that.
So, I mean, specifically, the attorney general's race was something that I covered, and whereas I could have seen maybe a different Democratic candidate winning, I did not expect Josh Shapiro to win based on, you know, how red the state went. He was such a progressive candidate in comparison to, you know, some of his opponents during the primary, like our attorney or our district attorney here, that I just, you know, based on where the numbers ended up falling, I didn't expect that at all. And I think, you know, at City Paper, we're still trying to figure out how he won.
Kim.
I think, you know, it's been an election year where the conventional wisdom has not applied to anything, that the polls were, you know, wrong to a huge degree in a lot of ways, and that, you know, all of our expectations about, you know, if this happens, then this will happen, you know, that none of that really sort of came to pass. And so to have all of these, you know, state-level offices go blue while the state went red for the president, it just seems to defy any kind of logic or conventional wisdom maybe that we've seen previously, that you would not necessarily expect things to have turned out this way. And yet we keep saying, well, why did it happen? And no one can sort of figure out what is the magic bullet? Maybe there isn't one. It was just a year that was unprecedented.
Chris Potter.
Yeah, I mean, I think a couple things are going on. One, with respect to the attorney general's race, Josh Shapiro raises money almost like nobody else in the state of Pennsylvania, and he comes out of Philadelphia, so that helps him. He was helped by having a fairly lackluster Republican rival state senator, John Rafferty, who just never really gave him much of a run for his money. And he's just, I mean, that guy's a force to be reckoned with, and I think he's sort of the kind of big hope for Democrats in this state going forward. In the treasurer's race, similar kind of dynamic, I think. You had Torsella, also from Philadelphia. If that helped them. As you mentioned, the Auditor General was an incumbent. So you had that going for those guys. I think also you didn't have the kinds of attack ads being lodged against them. And I think, you know, to some extent, it would not surprise me if gender played part of a role in this. It's conspicuous that the two female candidates running statewide as Democrats lost and the three men won.
Yeah, because if Philadelphia is going to help you, and that would have helped Katie McGinty, certainly. So I don't think you can rule out the fact that gender played a very big role.
Yeah, I agree with that, except that Katie McGinty was subjected to millions of dollars worth of negative ads, and Josh Shapiro never was.
Mm-hmm. All right, in our remaining 2 minutes of this segment, I do want to raise this question. So does Donald Trump's message, the way he packaged it, his demeanor, do you see this having an impact on future elections in the Pittsburgh region, or at whatever level of government, sort of causing a rise of Trump-style candidates or campaigns? We've just about 2 minutes. Jeremy, I'll start with you.
I haven't thought about that. I guess I'd have to say no. I mean,
so
just, his
thing
just
was
off
just,
the bat.
It was unique. It was Donald Trump.
I think it was unique, yeah, and I think on a national platform is maybe the only way it would work. I mean, just thinking about it initially, I don't know that you could do that on this kind of local level where the scrutiny is just totally different, you know, and the attitudes are different. You don't have that like broad sweep of the country to, you know, pick up your message and support that or not support it. So I'd say no to that one.
Kim Lyons.
I would almost say that, you know, Donald Trump was a unique candidate in much the way Barack Obama was a unique candidate, that there was no expectations. They were completely dashed by both candidates, and that I don't think anyone could duplicate what Donald Trump did. I think you'll have probably more people trying to do the opposite of what he did in coming elections to say, you know, I am not like this.
Chris Potter.
I was actually thinking about this in terms of the mayoral race. Somebody could run a Trump-style campaign against Bill Peduto by starting every sentence and ending every sentence with the words bike lanes. But I don't think it plays out in part because of the racial dynamics in Pittsburgh and the broader area here. There's a much larger minority population. I think that weighs against the success of a campaign like that succeeding here.
I think Chris Potter is onto something, and I think there might be a candidate that probably will not win. I think we're going to be sitting here a year from now having reelected Bill Peduto, but Darlene Harris could do it.
It's our year in review. We're discussing the top news stories of the year. Coming up, police and politics when the confluence continues on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're discussing some of the most impactful news stories of the year with Jeremy Boren, digital managing editor for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, Chris Potter, reporter for the Post-Gazette, Kim Lyons, a freelance reporter and writer, Rebecca Addison, news editor for Pittsburgh City Paper, and Mark Newtbar, senior reporter for WESA. A clash over a police chief speaking at the Democratic National Convention, a mass shooting in Wilkinsburg, concerns about youth violence in downtown Pittsburgh made headlines this year in Pittsburgh. Let's start with the horrific shootings in Wilkinsburg in March. A party on Franklin Avenue, two gunmen, 48 shots fired, five adults killed, including a woman and her unborn 8-month-old child, a revenge shooting for a robbery and shooting from years before. Let's start with what was the initial impact on the community? Mark, you were there that day.
Yeah, it was. I was spending more time in the other parts of Wilkinsburg and not right by the house. And it was interesting. People wanted to talk. That was what was clear for the most part. There were a few people that, you know, anytime you show a microphone, they're going to move away in the other direction. But people wanted to talk. And what they wanted to say was, we're not that bad. This is a better place to be than you might think. Then, you know, we've had some bad press. We had a really bad incident the other night. But we are getting better, and there is a lot of stuff to celebrate, and there's a place to come have dinner and, a place to do some shopping, and we have a busway. Come into Wilkinsburg, and you're going to find out it's better than it was.
Rebecca.
Something that I thought was interesting in the, the 24 hours following the shooting is there were a lot of vigils that happened. There were lots of marches that happened. I went to one where we marched around the block where the shooting had taken place. And something that I noticed is that, there were some Wilkinsburg people there, but mostly the people who were marching that night were people from other parts of the city who, had been familiar with, activism around, reducing violence. And those are the people who were mostly there. A lot of the neighbors around the incident were just staying in their houses that night. They didn't want to come out.
Jeremy, when you were talking to your reporters, what were you trying to, obviously you're trying to get the details of what happened. What else were you trying to get from this story?
Just to make any sense of it, the unique thing about that particular incident, it was horrible and, it happened in the middle of the night. So reporters and our photographers were out there, at like 1 a.m. or something when they finally, were starting to be able to take in the scene. And, I think initially it was just trying to, there was a huge question about how something like this could happen and why somebody would do something like this. And it was a real process, as I recall, just getting that, nailed down from authorities about, how this could happen. And it took quite a while to get kind of any context for it. Because I think initially, people worried that it was this random act of violence, but it really wasn't that, is what it turned out to be. And it was much more targeted. So just getting to that point was a real effort and important, I think, to let readers know.
And targeted, and you're alluding to what I mentioned, it was turned out to be basically a retaliation.
Right, exactly. And that, there were these elements of, there was a presence on social media that this event was happening in the backyard. And so, there was obviously somebody, did the research to figure out when and where certain people would be and, used that to their advantage. But it was only through really reporting the story and keeping after, investigators that come into focus. And I just remember that being an early frustration, that you couldn't get the context that you wanted as quickly as you wanted.
Rebecca.
I think what you said about it being retaliation just reveals so much about the reporting of the story. Early on, you hear mass shooting and every, news outlet in Pittsburgh and the surrounding area came out because these kinds of mass shootings get a lot of attention. What doesn't get attention are, the hundreds of retaliatory shootings that happen in Pittsburgh and the surrounding area throughout the year. So I think, as soon as everyone found out it was a retaliatory shooting, the coverage of this incident actually really went down.
Mark, have we learned anything of, how has the community rebounded? I mean, I know you were talking to some businesses and other people coming out of businesses, and I know that there have been some events over the months to try to
bring the community together and actually bring people into Wilkinsburg. Do we know how the community has responded, rebounded?
I don't know that there's any measurable effect, but I know that the churches have been doing a lot to reach out. I know there has been some investment into Wilkinsburg. There's been a lot of talk about, as I said, the busway and the train depot that they're working on and trying to do the renovation work there. As far as being able to really measure it, I think that is going to be measured in maybe even decades. It's just going to take a long time for Wilkinsburg to really be what it was once.
Let's talk a little bit about something that really gathered a lot of headlines. His name is Cameron McClay. Whether it was his speaking to the Democratic National Convention, whether it was apologizing to the African-American community for past transgressions by police officers against the community, or whether it was a no-confidence vote, et cetera. Of course, he resigned November 4th. He resigned November 4th. Was that a surprise to anybody here at this table? Chris Potter?
I was a little surprised just by the timing of the resignation. I think everyone knew when Bill Peduto was elected mayor that there was going to be stress between himself and the police, the rank and file police officers. I think everybody knew that, and I think Chief McClay was exactly the kind of police chief that Mr. Peduto sort of promised to bring on board, and I think a lot of police were worried that he would bring on board. So a lot of that stuff, that in the sort of end game, did I think it would necessarily happen because he gave a speech at the DNC? You know, I don't think anybody could have seen that coming. But I don't think as any surprise whatsoever that the tension between Mayor Peduto and the police force has been sort of one of the kind of continuing motifs of his administration. And that may well play out in a re-election campaign as well.
Mark Newpar, was it policies? You know, let's face it. He was, quote, an outsider.
Yeah, both. Well, yeah, outsiders don't always play well in the city of Pittsburgh, and I say that as at least what I used to be an outsider. I've been here for quite a while now. I just wonder if this doesn't shine a light, kind of what Chris was saying. Can somebody lead this department and make the community happy and make the rank and file happy? It should be able to happen, but have we gotten to the place where we have healed enough as a community that we're ready to really make some of those changes and reforms and attitude that both sides need to be making?
Kim.
Yeah, and I wonder, you know, was it too big of a leap for Mayor Peduto to appoint someone who was from outside of the area, who, you know, obviously had views that aligned very closely with his own as far as community policing were concerned, but did he make too big of a leap too fast? Would it have been better to have someone in a less visible position and learn about the department? Because as Mark said, you know, being an outsider in Pittsburgh, you know, myself for quite a few years ago, you know, it's a welcoming area in some ways, but not in all ways. And that sometimes it takes a little time to sort of elbow your way into conversations. Maybe it would have behooved Peduto and McClay if he had had an opportunity to come in at maybe a lower level or in a different capacity as a consultant. I'm not sure, not a specific role as the head of the department and be expected to cure the department's ills in, you know, a short period of time.
Jeremy Bourne?
I don't think I'm going out on a limb here, and if anybody disagrees with me, let me know. But I think that a big factor at play throughout Chief McClay's time here were the contract negotiations between the city and the police union, which were extremely contentious. We're going through arbitration, several levels of it that I think they're still mired in, if I'm not mistaken. And I think that one thing that happened was a pressure point was to be able to say about an outsider, somebody that hasn't come up through the ranks, that you don't have any particular loyalty to as a fellow officer. You know, you can launch criticisms and complaints sort of at will as a way to, you know, leverage your point into being or into the paper or on a, you know, TV news program, you know, by offering a criticism and, you know, also mentioning that, you know, it would be nice if police were paid more as well. So I think that, you know, if you look at comments, you know, whether it be from, you know, the police union or elsewhere, that was wrapped up in it. And I think that was a huge factor in that friction that you're talking about between the chief and the rank and file.
Chris? Chris Potter.
Yeah, although you would have to say in the mayor's defense, I mean, let's remember the context for this hiring. The previous police chief had been convicted of offenses. The department was kind of scandal-ridden. To hire an outsider, I think it was almost a campaign promise. I don't think the mayor came out and said, I'd be doing it, but he made it very clear that it would be a national search. And I think you didn't have to read too far between the lines to know that that meant it was going to be somebody coming from outside the area. The other thing I just say, too, police issues have vexed mayors for decades in this city. David Lawrence struggled with issues about policing and corruption within that department, and he never negotiated them. So this was always going to be difficult for the mayor. It's not to say that things shouldn't have been played a little differently. It's not to say that that Chief McClay made a good decision by showing up in uniform on the stage there. I mean, that is a dangerous thing to do, because there's the Federal Hatch Act, there are local rules and things like that that really circumscribe your ability to go out there. Even though he didn't endorse a candidate, he just talked about good community policing. I think the police union had a good point. This was an explicitly political event that he appeared at in uniform, and I think I can understand why that became contentious.
Was it one thing more than another, or was it a compilation of the appearing at the DNC, of apologizing to the African-American community, the contract negotiations? Was it just one on top of another, or was there one that sort of was the tipping point? Mark?
I think that it was leading toward that death by a thousand cuts. But when he went and spoke, then all of a sudden it seemed like here's, to use another term, an impeachable offense. Here is something that now seems to break a rule. Isn't just, we don't feel comfortable with this, we don't like this. You now broke a rule. So let's go ahead with that no confidence vote.
Rebecca.
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree that that was definitely the straw that broke the camel's back, but only because they knew, his opponents knew that they could use that. But like, let's keep in mind that he was off to a bad start from the beginning. Last New Year's, I believe it was, or maybe 2 New Years ago, he held what was a strong message, a sign that said, I pledge to end white silence at work. But it's an innocuous message. Like, there's nothing about that message that would vilify police in any way. And yet, after he held that sign, it was, police unions across the country coming out and, being outraged about this. But it wasn't something that in any way was an attack on police officers.
But the police officers, the unions might have vilified him, but your perception that he was pretty well respected in the community, is that a fair assumption?
Absolutely. I think, if you ask anyone, I don't think the community realized that, or I think they were very surprised that he resigned. I think they felt like it was a little too good to be true, though, throughout this whole thing. Someone who was so responsive, who came in right away, held all these community meetings across the city and apparently was there for them. Groups like the Alliance for Police Accountability was there for them whenever they had a concern and was willing to work with them to address those concerns. I think they thought it was too good to be true, but I don't think they saw this coming at all.
Jeremy.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think he had built a good relationship and had shown up at a lot of events that you might not have expected previous police chiefs to appear at. They would have sent a surrogate. And I think it was important to him to build those relationships early and often, and he managed to do that.
On the day that Chief McClay resigned, an acting chief was named, Scott Schubert, sort of given the job to, I asked the mayor recently, I said, so is it his job to lose? He goes, it's his job to win. What does Schubert have to do to win the job and balance rank and file? Yes, he has come up through the ranks, but balance the rank and file, accepting him, whatever, versus the community, which was supportive of Cam McClay. Chris Potter.
Boy, I don't know. It's a job I'm glad I don't have. Let's put it that way. I mean, I do think, as Rebecca pointed out, there's a community out there in Pittsburgh that's very concerned right now, in part because of the national election. There's a lot of concerns, I think, about what a Donald Trump administration will mean for law and order and how we go after communities of color in particular. So I think he's inheriting a lot of that stuff. I'm not qualified to say what he needs to do. There are clearly internal issues. I think Jeremy alluded to some of them. I have a sense as well that because the community loves somebody doesn't necessarily mean that his style of administration was particularly admired within the force. And I think those are some of the issues that have to be addressed as well. It's a hugely complicated job being the police chief in a city of any size. And this one, based on the history we have here, it's not going to be easy.
Rebecca.
And I think that even though, as I said, he was very beloved by the community, there was such a disconnect that you should have been able to see that it was never actually going to work. So the mayor's office is publishing, these press releases saying that they're doing all these different transparency efforts with policing data and stuff like that. Yet, the news media still, when they contact the police department, can't get simple data that they need. So, and then you hear about all these different community policing initiatives at the top, but the rank and file officers down at the bottom aren't learning about them. They're not, and they have told me they're not receiving the appropriate training. So from the beginning, it was this idea that, sure, we have come up with these great new initiatives, but they were not trickling down to even, lower levels at the highest levels of administration.
Mark Newport.
If the acting chief wants to be given the job permanently, I think he has to find some allies in city council. I think he needs to spend a lot of time in their offices figuring out how to ingratiate himself to them.
30 seconds left. Cam McClay said, urged the police force, urged his successor to stay the course. Will the successor stay the course, or is that a dangerous road if you want to hold on to the job?
I think it begs the question, what is the course? I mean, what did he, was he in office long enough to have really charted a clear path forward, or was he sort of trying to do too much too quickly? I think, the person who has this job next, whether it's Schubert or somebody else, is going to have to figure out what that path forward is, what it looks like, and where the course leads and why.
We're talking about the top news stories of the year in the Pittsburgh area. More ahead on The Confluence, where the news comes together. The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. From a burning bridge to a flooding roadway, it's a review of the top news stories in the Pittsburgh area. And we once again mention our guests, and we thank them for being here. Jeremy Boren, digital managing editor for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Chris Potter, reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Kim Lyons, freelance reporter and writer. Rebecca Addison is news editor for Pittsburgh City Paper. And Mark Newtbar is senior reporter for WESA. Let's start this segment with Pittsburgh Public Schools getting a new superintendent, Anthony Hamlin. Of course, some controversy over his appointment, allegations of plagiarism, embellishing his resume in terms of academic performance of his students. Rebecca, let's start with you.
So for anyone who's been covering education in the city for a while, the appointment of a new superintendent, especially someone who came from outside of the city, was kind of an exciting time. Because one of the problems with Superintendent Linda Lane is that she had, been in Pittsburgh Public Schools under the Mark Roosevelt administration. So any new idea that she had basically carried kind of that weight, that a lot of people had not liked Mark Roosevelt and thus would not like her. So it was a very exciting time when we picked someone from outside of the district. And then, obviously, within days, everyone was reporting that he had lied on his resume and plagiarized a statement for his mission statement. And it just kind of blew the wind out of the sails for a lot of us who were looking forward to a fresh start. And I don't know that that enthusiasm has recovered. He obviously is our superintendent today and has skated through that controversy, but I don't think too many people are very excited about any of the new programs or policies that he's put in place.
Chris Potter.
Yeah, I mean, as somebody who helped break those stories with my colleague Molly Bourne at the Post-Gazette, it was a difficult story to do in a lot of ways because, of course, what we did is what newspapers and media outlets always do, which is they check the credentials of a new hire. We've done it since then. We've done it before. But as Rebecca kind of suggests, I mean, part of what was going on there is it got written into a much broader narrative, which is about what direction you take a district in. The previous administration had been very much in a sort of quote-unquote reform kind of mode where the use of standardized tests as a key measure of teacher performance had been very much an issue. A new school board had been elected, really much of which just months before the hiring process began, and they had been running against that. So this was also sort of an early referendum, not just on this hire, but on the board doing the hiring. And I think it got to be a very fractious issue in part for that reason.
What's it say when the news media has to do the credential checking and search firms and others in the district itself didn't necessarily check as well as they should have? Jeremy Bourne.
I mean, that was a big part of the story, is that they hired a search firm to perform what you would assume would be a rigorous vetting of potential candidates.
And had they done this before?
No.
Yeah.
They had not, at least not in this way, not for this type of district, and I don't think for a superintendent at all, if I remember. And so that raised a huge question about even how did we find this search firm in the first place and why were they selected? And it wasn't as though there was this tremendous number of candidates. It wouldn't have been a huge task to look and verify that the things that were on somebody's resume were legitimate. So that was almost as worrisome as the actual plagiarism.
It seems from what Rebecca said, has he rebounded from this or not? Rebecca, you were a little bit so saying, well, yeah, he's back and he's rolling.
I mean, I think the controversy has died down, but I don't know that anything he's done has really proven that he deserves the job yet.
Yeah, so he's held a bunch of, was it in every single district of the school board? Was that a good thing? Has anything come out of that? What do we know?
I'd say it was a good thing. It definitely, you know, was lip service to the public who want more of a role in their schools. But no, I don't know that any concrete plans have come out of those meetings.
Okay.
And if you were at those meetings, do you think you met anybody that hadn't been at meetings just like that previously? The same voices that were heard.
Correct.
Let's move on to the Liberty Bridge. It caught fire September 2nd, closed for many, many days, affecting tens of thousands of motorists, millions of dollars. Mark Newport, I know you were there at one of the news conferences covering that story.
Fines still to be figured out, right? We don't know what is the repercussion of this. How does something like this happen? It's just kind of weird. You know, you look at a steel bridge and you're like, it caught fire. I'll give kudos to the city to all of the drivers in the city for figuring out very quickly how to deal with it. I don't have to come in from the South Hills, so I didn't bear the brunt of it, but that first day was just absolutely awful. I don't know. How can you safeguard against something like that? Mistakes are going to happen.
It's funny because it seems like that's the common thread through all of the stories we're talking about today. How could something like this happen? Well, it keeps happening.
Wasn't that your job to find out?
Yes, absolutely. But it's funny because I do live in the South Hills, and I was on vacation when this happened to Liberty. Yes, very good for me. And I saw it on the national news, and I said, holy cow, that's going to tie up things in the South Hills terribly. Because if you remember at the time, the red line was out of commission for the most part between Potomac and Fallowfield, which is a major stretch of the red line. They were using shuttle buses, which already was making things problematic and difficult. A large swath of Potomac Avenue, Dormont, was closed, which is a major thoroughfare through the Dormont and into other parts of the South Hills. And then so to close the Liberty Bridge off, it felt like either people didn't want us to come out of the South Hills or didn't want to come into the South Hills. It felt like it was kind of a conspiracy against those of us living in the South Hills. And so it just seemed like it could not have been a worse summer for a resident of those neighborhoods. I think we've come through the trauma a little bit now, but it seemed like all things were converging in a way that was not very, very promising.
In the category of how could that happen, flooded roadway, Washington Boulevard. Some people in August had to be rescued from their vehicles. This happened almost 5 years to the day that a tragic event happened, similar with four people dying as a result. And how could it happen again? They put up floodgates and they hadn't been inspected in 3 years. How can that happen?
Nobody was told to do it. That's why. You can't just buy something and put it in place and then walk away. You have to make sure that somebody actually, you know, cleans up the system and make sure that they test it every once in a while.
And who was in charge was also up for debate.
That was the big question.
Nobody.
Right.
Was it
in charge of the inspections and who is supposed to initiate what? Yeah. And I think there was a lot of kind of back and forth and lack of...
Well, I thought you were.
Yeah.
You know.
Right, exactly.
Well, speaking of infrastructure, roadways, self-driving cars, they got a lot of attention. A lot of media members took the rides along. You know, is this, I don't want to say put Pittsburgh on the map, but Pittsburgh got a lot of attention internationally with this story. Chris Potter.
Yeah, I'm one of those uber agnostics. I'm struck by the fact that anytime a factory, for example, closes down, they move production overseas, there's always a story about, oh God, the American workers had to train their, Bengalese replacements, and isn't that a shame? And yet when it's time to train the robots to drive the cars, everybody thinks it's neat, right? We somehow resist more other carbon-based life forms getting work than we do a silicon-based system taking the jobs away from us. I tend to be very, and I think 2016 would bear me out on this, I tend to be very suspicious of sort of technological utopian visions for things. Obviously, the technology is neat. We've all seen them like driving around town, spinning the colanders on top or whatever those things are. But I do wish that one thing that were happening in this, not just in this city, but in this country, were a discussion of the dislocations caused by technology, because that has had a much bigger impact, especially on those kind of working class jobs that have been so much of issue. A lot of those folks are more affected by automation than they are by trade.
Rebecca Addison.
So I do think it's kind of interesting, that this kind of thing was innovated in Pittsburgh. If you've been covering any of the unionization rallies or the Fight for 15 marches going on, Pittsburgh is a union town, is what they'll tell you. So in a place that, is so, workforce friendly and has such a dedication to good paying jobs, it's strange that we are now being celebrated as also a hub for a innovation that has taken jobs away.
I think it shows just how needy we are, though, for a win. Right, they roll this out in San Francisco, and San Francisco shuts it down, or at least tries to right away. But here we are saying, come look at us. Watch as we, do whatever we're going to do. I was about to say something probably overly flippant, but, we needed to win. We had to have something. And look, we've got the best self-driving cars ever.
Jeremy.
Yeah, and to that point, it also instantly exposed that Pennsylvania has almost no regulations for this whatsoever for the testing of a potentially, dangerous type of new technology. I mean, hopefully not, but there were some incidents, I believe, in San Francisco, and part of the reason it got shut down.
Chris Potter.
Yeah, to Mark's point, Pittsburgh offered the perfect blend of high-tech expertise and low self-esteem. I think those are the two things you have to go with.
No regulation.
Good point. It speaks to what happens then when Uber has developed the driverless car, when they have that technology perfected. Are they going to keep this race, this test track that they have in El Mono? Are they going to keep all these jobs in the strip district that they have? I think we could maybe look to an airline that was in here many years ago and built us a hub and then didn't need us anymore and kind of dumped us and went on their way. So, I wouldn't suggest that Uber was going to do that. However, I think maybe we could learn a few lessons before we are so needy and welcoming of a new company coming in.
Okay, now remaining 2 minutes, about 20 seconds for each of you. A story that you anticipate being big in 2017. Mark Newtbar.
Watch Bill Peduto and his administration try to figure out how to squeeze $10 million out of the Rivers Casino when the state legislature doesn't come through with more taxing authority.
You don't think they're going to act by the late January deadline to pass a new law?
I have seen Harrisburg not act on behalf of Pittsburgh and other small municipalities too many times to believe they're going to get their act together to do it.
Chris Potter.
Watch how local officials and local voters, especially those who supported Donald Trump, react once the policies actually start getting handed down, because there's a lot of distance between what you say on the trail and what you actually pledge, and I'm not sure those folks know what's coming.
When do we think we're going to get the first inkling?
On Inauguration Day, and probably not a minute before.
Okay. Jeremy Boren, something happening in 2017.
Yes, and to play off of that a little bit, I mean, people are energized by the election. They have thoughts one way or another about how the presidential election went. But in the municipal elections next year, let's see how many uncontested races there are, and then we'll see how excited people are for the political process and getting involved themselves.
Political process, interest in elections in an off election year?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Probably won't happen.
Get the statewide judicial races,
right.
Kevin.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Wait. Yeah.
Kim Lyons, 20 seconds.
I think that it's going to be interesting to see how energized people stay and how Democrats, if they take a page out of the Tea Party's book and get their base energized to obstruct and roadblock and everything that the Republican Congress and Donald Trump try to do.
Rebecca Addison, the good news is you had time to think. The bad news is they might have taken all your ideas.
No, I think I have a completely different idea, which is that we should all stay tuned for what's going to unfold with the Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority in the coming months with the lead contamination and also, you know, who dropped the buck with the different changes in operations over there.
All right. We'd like to thank our panelists for this year in review program. Jeremy Bourne, digital managing editor for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Chris Potter is a reporter for the Post-Gazette. Kim Lyons, freelance reporter and writer. Rebecca Addison is news editor for Pittsburgh City Paper. And Mark Newtbar is senior reporter for WESA. Folks, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Kevin.
Thank you.
Now, for this week and for this year, that's The Confluence. Thanks for listening. WESA's director of engineering is Russ Loy. The engineer for this broadcast is Tom Hurley. The producer for The Confluence is Marcus Charleston. I'm Kevin Gavin, hoping your 2017 is filled with good news.